I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the February 2022 edition of Pianist, John Evans recalls the recently deceased Brazilian pianist, Nelson Freire. The music world is mourning Nelson Freire, a pianist of rare quality who tempered his prodigious musical gifts and a capacity for life with a genuine regard for the instrument's past masters. I was fortunate to speak with him at the London offices of Decca Records in 2014. The occasion was the release of a 2-CD collection of his broadcast recordings from 1968 to 1979, performances that shone a light on the 70-year-old pianist after a career spent partly in the shadows. I was struck by his serenity, humility, and perfect manners, qualities that were also evident in his playing. However, he was surprisingly open, too, at one point revealing how he miraculously survived a bus crash in which his parents were killed, a tragedy he admitted he'd only recently been able to talk about publicly. Born in Brazil in 1944, from a young age, Freire, a child prodigy, was destined for a career as a concert pianist. His parents changed jobs so they could leave their sleepy hometown of Boa Esperança for the bustling city of Rio de Janeiro in pursuit of teachers who could nurture and develop their talented son. There he was taught by Lucia Branco, a former student of Arthur de Graeff, who was taught by Franz Liszt. Other people close to Freire in those early years could claim similar connections to the same composer, and also to Chopin. I consider myself a privileged person who learned as a child what came from the past, he told me when we met, adding that Rachmaninoff, Novais, Horowitz, Rubinstein, Gieseking, Gilels, and Michelangeli were the pianists who interested him the most. At the age of 12, he performed Beethoven's Emperor Piano Concerto, and at 13, came seventh in the Rio de Janeiro International Piano Competition, an achievement that earned him a scholarship to study in Vienna the following year. He was there for 2 years, during which time he formed what would be a lifelong friendship with a pianist destined for the front rank, Martha Argerich. The pair appeared in concert many times. However, as he told me during his interview, he became distracted by the Viennese life. I rather neglected my studies, instead enjoying the café life a bit too much. I learned to live in Vienna and saved the music for later when I had digested it. In this age of young superstar pianists, who appear to arrive ready-formed and be in a headlong rush to establish themselves before the next newcomer elbows them aside, this admission comes as a surprise until you realize that as a child, Freire found music and playing came easily to him. I had a normal childhood and clever parents who didn't force me to practice beyond 2 hours a day, he told me. If you spend your life only practicing, what are you going to express in your music? You shouldn't shut out life when you are young. I see artists today who seem obsessed not even by music, but by their careers. I'd hate to be starting out now. There's too much pressure. Unfortunately, Freire's fondness for Viennese cafe culture meant that when, at the end of his studies, he returned to Rio, he wasn't as accomplished a pianist as his friends and associates had expected. Crushed by the weight of their disappointment, he abandoned the piano altogether until, in 1962, aged 18, he gave a well-received concert in the city that led him in 1964 to enter the Queen Elizabeth competition in Brussels. He finished nowhere, but a few days later, he entered the Vienna de Motta International Music Competition in Lisbon, at which, remarkably, he won first prize. Shortly afterwards, in London, he was awarded the Dino Libati Medal. Nelson Freire was on his way, and then, 3 years later, tragedy struck when the bus he and his parents were traveling in to Boa Esperanza, where Freire was to give a concert, left the road and plunged down a ravine. Everyone apart from Freire and a fellow passenger was killed. Freire himself only survived because half an hour before the accident, he had changed places with his father to escape a draft. "I escaped with nothing but a cut to my hand," he told me. "It is only recently that I have been able to talk about the accident." That he could was thanks to his relationship with music, a relationship that had supported and sustained him before as a child. "Growing up, I suffered serious allergies and spent long periods on my own," he told me. "I felt cockeyed. It was only when I played the piano," he mimicked his sister's playing before he had any lessons, "that I could see into another, happier dimension, and that feeling has remained with me ever since. I don't know what I'd do without music. It is my oxygen." Nelson Freire had an inexhaustible supply of it. Following his 1964 success in Lisbon, he was in demand the world over, at his height giving 60 concerts a year, recording for many of the major labels, and establishing a reputation as a warm and sensitive artist, albeit one who avoided excessive self-promotion. Thanks to his early teachers, as well as his capacity for quickly absorbing music, he had a vast repertoire and was loath to focus on one composer or their collected works. In recent years, he had planned to play and record more Schumann, Schubert, and Scriabin, plus music by French composers Poulenc and Ravel. He considered himself to be an instinctive pianist. "I'm not an intellectual," he told me. "I can't rationalize the way I play. The music just flows." A pianist once told me he didn't believe in inspiration. I disagree. It was why he never listened to his own recordings. "Music is natural and unrepeatable. Your interpretation changes while a recording stays the same." Freire was often referred to as a pianist's pianist. If this means he was loved by his peers but not so well known by the wider public, then perhaps he was. Despite his wide discography and busy concert schedule, even he admitted he was not an instantly recognizable name, a fact he suggested may have been to do with his distaste for self-promotion. "People say I was lazy, that I relied too much on my natural technique and my excellent sight reading and memorizing skills," he told me. "Maybe they are right. They say I could have promoted myself harder too, but I care only for the music." And his dogs. Away from the stage in the studio, Freire told me he loved the company of his two boxer dogs, which he enjoyed taking on long strolls in Rio. "They have serious faces, but the sweetest eyes," he said. He also admitted to enjoying old Hollywood movies of the 1940s and 50s. I love dark thrillers with stars like Richard Widmark and Rita Hayworth. Bette Davis, what an actress. I belong to that period. What he struggled with, he said, was living among people. Fortunately, this didn't prevent him communicating with them through his recordings. Nelson Freire has died, but his music lives on. In the BBC Music magazine for July of 2022, Tom Service says classical crossover is nothing to get cross over. Classical crossover. A term that makes purists recoil, that defines a genreless genre that has classical musical culture up in arms, even while it has non-specialist charts in its thrall. Yet crossover's essential philosophy isn't as separate from classical ideology as purists might like to think. And neither is it as genuinely open-hearted in its crossing of genres as its fans might suppose. Crossover is about turning the ambition of the operatic into the glamour of the poperatic, fusing the emotional scale of classical music with the marketing and sound world of pop. The result ought to be records, performances, and careers that appeal to the biggest possible audience with the greatest possible impact. And it works. It's not only that Ludovico Einaudi, André Rieu, Catherine Jenkins, Michael Ball, and Alfie Beau usually sell more records than musicians who confine themselves to the uncrossed-over classical. They're only the latest manifestations of a phenomenon that goes back to the start of the record industry. Enrico Caruso and Nelly Melba were doing something similar in their recording careers, singing operatic offcuts, folk songs, and popular tunes in new arrangements to sell millions of 78s. And between those recording pioneers and today's crossover artists is a chain of connection from Mario Lanza to the three tenors, from Kenneth McKellar to Andrea Bocelli. And there's another sense in which the snobbery directed at crossover is both misplaced and ahistorical. Without crossing popular musical theater with Masonic ritual and operatic virtuosity, Mozart's The Magic Flute couldn't have been composed. Without crossing Renaissance polyphony with Baroque counterpoint and romantic sublimity, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis wouldn't have been written. And without fusing oratorio with song cycle, symphony, and opera of the imagination, Mahler's Eighth Symphony couldn't exist. The weirdness of the music in today's classical crossover charts is that it's less likely to cross genres than contemporary classical music. Crossover is now a separate genre of production, product and performance that's defined by and cosseted in its own realm of poperatic sheen, which doesn't, ironically, cross over with anything other than itself. It used to be so different, and if you want to experience the true power of what's possible when opera meets pop, a place in which the crossover equation, more plus more equals most, really does shake the foundations of the sky, you need to hear Freddie Mercury's album with Montserrat Caballé, Barcelona. The meeting of those voices crosses the streams of musical genres to produce something irresistibly excessive that flies into a new musical dimension. prepare to travel with Freddy and Montserrat to Crossover and beyond. To Barcelona! In the BBC Music Magazine for July of 2022, Elizabeth de Brito introduces us to American composer George Walker. George Walker boasts one of the longest compositional careers in history, writing well into his 90s. In his prolific career, he produced over 90 works, an enviable array of masterpieces, including concertos for trombone and piano, 5 piano sonatas, 5 sinfonias, brass quintets, wind quintets, song cycles, and more. He wrote most extensively, though, for stringed instruments, with a violin concerto and cello concerto, sonatas for cello, violin, and viola, and 2 string quartets to his name. But as well as being an extraordinary composer and musician, he was a trailblazer for black people. Racism would offer numerous setbacks during his lifetime, derailing his career as a concert pianist and ensuring he would consistently struggle for his work to be recognized. But now that we are in his centenary year, as new recordings emerge and performances and studies increase, hopefully George Walker can enter the canon as one of the greatest American composers, his genius truly recognized. Born and raised in Washington, D.C., Walker grew up in a supportive, nurturing household full of music, his father a well-respected local physician. Young George began piano lessons at the age of 5, quickly displaying every sign of being a prodigy. At 10, he was enrolled at the local Howard University's music prep school, from which he would graduate at just 14. He would also find early employment as a musician during church services. Turning down a scholarship to Howard University itself, he chose instead to study away from home at Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio. In doing so, he became not only the youngest, but also the only black student at the prestigious institution, the first of many such instances in which he would tread a path for others to follow. It was with the initial intention of becoming a concert pianist and on a full scholarship that Walker entered Oberlin. During his time there, he was exposed to some of the great pianists of his age, including Rachmaninoff, who he saw perform live in 1938 in a memorable concert that left a great impression. Oberlin also offered him his first performance opportunities, and at his senior recital he played Tchaikovsky's 1st piano concerto with the Conservatory Orchestra, receiving a standing ovation from the packed house. Studying composition with Norman Lockwood, he also wrote his first pieces, the Caprice for piano and Responses for voice and piano. After graduating with honors in 1941, he went on to attend the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, studying piano with Rudolf Serkin, composition with Rosario Scalero, and orchestration with Giancarlo Menotti. Among the lifelong friends he made there were the fellow future pianists Walter Hauzig, Jacob Lateiner, and Seymour Lipkin, who would later conduct the world premiere of his Lyric for Strings in 1946, originally part of his String Quartet No. 1, written as a postgraduate, it would go on to become known as Walker's most famous piece. Walker left Curtis in 1945 with 2 artist diplomas in piano and composition. That same year, giving his debut recital at Town Hall in New York, in a program that included his own Piano Sonata No. 2. 2 weeks later, his debut with the Philadelphia Orchestra in Rachmaninoff's 3rd piano concerto under Eugene Ormandy followed. Yet, Despite these successes, progress proved tough due to his race. "It took me 5 years to get concert management," he later recalled. "I had friends who had done what I had done, and they got management immediately. But I was the most gifted piano student at Curtis. Everybody knew that. Yet they were the ones that got management. I went to Europe and played in 7 countries because I thought it would help get concerts here. It didn't." In 1950, he finally secured management with National Concert Artists, the first black instrumentalist to be signed to a major management company. Engagement still proved elusive, though, even when the concerts he did play met with acclaim. "Those successes were meaningless," he told the New York Times in 1982, "because without the sustained effect of follow-up concerts, my career had no momentum. And because I was black, I couldn't get either major or minor dates." In the meantime, the studies continued, as did the trailblazing. After becoming the first African-American to earn a doctorate at New York's Eastman School of Music in 1956, he received a Fulbright Fellowship to study with Daria Boulanger in Paris. "You are a composer," proclaimed the legendary pedagogue at his first lesson, describing his Piano Sonata No. 2 as a masterpiece. She would become an important mentor. The 1960s saw the beginning of what would be a long career in academia, with most of the decade spent teaching piano at Smith College, in 1968 becoming its first black tenured professor. The stable income of a teaching position afforded him the opportunity to devote more time to composition, and in 1964 he won the Harvey Gall Prize for his Sonata for 2 Pianos. Other works from this period include Antiphonus for Chamber Orchestra, Spatials for Piano, his only 12-tone work, Perimeters for Clarinet and Piano, and his second string quartet. And further success came with a Guggenheim Fellowship and a visitor professorship at the University of Colorado, before he became a full-tenured professor at Rutgers University in 1969, a post he would hold until his retirement in 1992. It was in 1971, just short of his 50th birthday, that Walker gained his first recording contract, performing several of his own piano works, including Sonata No. 2, Spatials, and Spectra. In addition, Natalie Hindertus recorded his first piano sonata, and further fame came in 1973 with the Black Composer series. The now iconic CBS Masterworks series, including a recording of his Trombone Concerto and Lyric for Strings, performed by the LSO under Paul Freeman. Walker was becoming well-established, with a steady stream of commissions that would continue throughout the rest of his life. In 1975, the National Endowment of the Arts commissioned his piano concerto, premiered by the Minneapolis Symphony and Paul Freeman, and later recorded by Hindertus. He was also greatly respected by fellow pianists, such as Leon Bates, who commissioned and premiered his 3rd piano sonata in 1976, and Frederick Moyer, who commissioned his 4th piano sonata in 1985, later recording it. The 1980s also brought major works such as his cello concerto, commissioned by the New York Philharmonic, and an Eastman Overture, commissioned by his alma mater, the Eastman School. It was in 1995 that the Boston Symphony commissioned him to write a piece for voice and orchestra, honoring the great black tenor, Roland Hayes. The resulting Lilacs, which set the Whitman poem "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed," a reflection on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, saw Walker became the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize for Music. To mark the achievement, Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry later declared 17th of June George Walker Day to honor and commemorate a composer born and raised in the city. Now an octogenarian, Walker's compositional output took on greater innovations after his retirement from teaching. His extraordinary violin concerto of 2008 was a present for his son Gregory, an eminent violinist and composer who would go on to record it with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Walker followed this up with another gift for Gregory in 2011, the short but intense encore Bleu. Family connections were important to the composer, whose 1971 Lament was written in his grandmother's memory, and whose 1991 Poem for violin and orchestra was dedicated to his mother. In 2017, a year before his death, the 95-year-old Walker saw a lifelong dream fulfilled when Chineke performed the UK premiere of his lyric for strings at the BBC Proms. Nearly 70 years separate that early masterpiece with Walker's final completed work, 2015's Sinfonia No. 5, Visions, which, spurred by the Charleston Massacre, combines Walker's own spoken text with the orchestra in a powerful tribute to the victims. This year, the 27th of June, marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of George Walker, whose remarkable career took him from a youthful piano prodigy to a nonagenarian genius of compositional complexity. Thanks not at least to Albany Records, with whom he enjoyed a long recording relationship, we are able to enjoy a great deal of his music, much of it performed by Gregory, its finest interpreter. His centenary year is surely the perfect time to explore his life, music, and legacy as one of the great American composers. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.